It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and Let's Talk Legal.
The right advice at the right time from Let's Talk Legal and Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law, and Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins in the studio. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Ben.
Hope everybody is well here this morning.
We are here.
Okay. All right. What are we talking about today?
Ben, last week we discussed guardianship, that being, of course, a, if you will, a part of the law that is a section of a substantive area of the law under the areas of elder law. We've spent the last few weeks in that area discussing various aspects of elder law, and anyone who has any questions concerning any of those aspects is welcome to call us either here here during this program or at the office and lodge a call, lodge a question. We'll be glad to answer it. But one of the aspects of elder law, no question, that we're called on a weekly basis is the issue of guardianship. Today, we did talk about it some last week, but today we'd like to talk about some of the practical, really kind of some of what, some of the terminology and who some of these people are. And just to start right off the top, it is a special proceeding, with the Superior Court, with the Clerk of Superior Court. And one of the first things that the Clerk of Superior Court is going to do when a petition for guardianship is filed is that the clerk, he or she, is going to then appoint the, quote, guardian ad litem. And we want to talk today about what in the world that is. What does that word mean? And who is that person and what is their function?
Okay.
We'll talk about that and some other things.
Okay. Again, it's a step-by-step procedure there, too, with guardianship. So what are we talking about then?
Well, we're filing basically it's a form document, but there's a lot of detail in that document. It's called a petition for adjudication of incompetence and appointment of a guardian. That's what starts the ball rolling. You know, we talked last week about this, and, you know, we don't take filing guardianships lightly. You know, we've got to make sure the circumstances fit for the guardianship, you know, to be filed, assuming we're representing the petitioner and doing the filing. Sometimes we're on the other side of the case, and maybe the respondent, the person that, or other family members, the respondent would be the person that is allegedly incompetent.
Right.
You know, we sometimes might be representing that individual against the petition for adjudication, or we might be representing other family members, depending on the circumstances. But nevertheless, that's what starts the process, filing that petition with the court. It's a pretty quick process, really, in North Carolina. You know, typically when you're looking at, as our listeners know, when you're talking about lawsuits, civil, superior court, district court type lawsuits, I mean, hey, you know, sometimes it takes more than a year. Most times it takes more than a year to finally get to trial because there's so much discovery to do. But really on a,
guardianship, you got to move quickly. Sometimes.
Well, you got to move quickly, and also the issues are narrowed. I mean, we're not looking into things like attacking documents and saying you misused these funds or doing those kind of things. Now, that those might be, you know, bits of evidence that come in as it relates to who should or should not be the guardian. But really, the issues that are narrowed by statute and by the petition that we file is really twofold. There, it comes down to is the person incompetent, number one, and number two, who's the best person to serve as guardian for this person? So since those issues are narrowed, we can get to the answer to those pretty quickly and get to a hearing relatively quickly.
So the first step about determining competency then, is that a medical decision or a legal decision, or is it both?
Well, the determination is defined really in the statute as a legal determination, but however, you know, us laymen sometimes need the opinion of a medical doctor as to certain specific questions, you know, regarding what level are we dealing with as far as level of being incompetent. So sometimes, yeah, absolutely, you have to have expert witness testimony as it relates to whether the individual is incompetent. Now, most clerks of court, they want to see a doctor's letter with the petition that's filed. And, you know, the doctor's letter would need to indicate that the individual is incompetent or use words similar to that, indicating that it's the opinion of the doctor that a guardian needs to be appointed to take care of you know, the medicines and finances or whatever the opinion is.
Is it sometimes that opinion also like this person may be a danger to themselves
yep.
or that kind of thing?
Yep, absolutely. Now, the clerks like to see that.
Mm-hmm.
The statute doesn't require that.
Mm-hmm.
But really, clerks are reluctant in many cases to proceed and certainly find an adjudication without having that letter or some kind of evidence mm-hmm. of actual incompetence. Now, the flip side of that is sometimes you can't get a doctor's letter because the person who you think is incompetent is just unwilling to cooperate with regard to anything.
Yeah, they don't go to the doctor.
And it won't go to the doctor. So then you find yourself in a position where if you really think this person is incompetent, needs the help, needs the assistance of the court, needs a guardian to be appointed, then, you know, within 10 days of filing your petition, you need to request a multidisciplinary evaluation, which basically is a built-in provision in the statute that allows you to basically require the respondent to go to the doctor and get checked out.
Hmm.
So the clerk then enters an order.
It's like a subpoena. Huh?
Yeah, pretty much. But, I mean, we've got to have that medical determination made.
Mm-hmm.
And if the person that we think is incompetent is, in fact, incompetent, sometimes we just can't get them to the doctor, you know, voluntarily. So
right.
the law doesn't support a breach of the peace where we're going to, you know, handcuff the person and take them to the doctor of our choice. Instead, there's an orderly process that mm-hmm. we go through, which is this motion for multidisciplinary evaluation. The particular doctor, medical professional is identified by the clerk of court. The procedure for this to take place is identified in the order from mm-hmm. the court. Usually in those orders, we have language about who's going to pick the person up and take them to the doctor, who's going to set the appointment, who's going to be at the appointment. Because, you know, you might have one child who's saying mm-hmm. incompetent and another child saying she's not incompetent.
Right.
You know, we really want hands off. We want it between the appointment to be between the respondent and the doctor.
Right.
Yep.
Now, Ben, hovering around all of this, as I was saying earlier, is a guardian ad litem. And this is the person that the clerk of court will appoint. It many times in many counties is an attorney, doesn't have to be an attorney. It sometimes is an individual that has become a friend of the court and has some experience with these procedures and has done many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And basically it is an independent person. It's not the attorney or person representing the petitioner, nor is it necessarily anyone related in the family, nor is it really an arm of the court, if you will. It's a very independent arbiter of the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And they go out and make their own independent investigation. They look at the living circumstances of the person. They look at their financial dealings. They look at the medical records, as well as the medical circumstances, such as Wes was mentioning, whether or not they're able to take their medication, how cooperative they are. They speak, of course, with the person if they can, and any other any kind of attending circumstances. The more thorough and sifting their investigation can be, the better.
Mm-hmm.
They have full authority to make a thorough and sifting evaluation and investigation, and then they render a report.
Mm-hmm.
And they, of course, are also present and available for testimony at the hearing. This is a very important piece of the guardianship puzzle, as one would now understand to be.
Yeah.
Because, again, the guardianship proceeding is so... such a significant legal event
mm-hmm.
for the alleged incompetent person. I mean, after all, if they are adjudicated incompetent, they are not allowed to sign legal documents.
Mm-hmm.
They're not allowed to sign or not competent to sign a last will and testament. They're not competent to make a vote,
mm-hmm.
to vote in any kind of election. They many times at that point they're not able to have a driver's license.
Right. Own a gun.
Many
right.
Consequences as a result of an adjudication of incompetency. So obviously our statutes have this safeguard.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, as they should, to have a guardian ad litem appointed, paid for by the taxpayers to protect the rights of the alleged incompetent person.
All right. We'll take a short break. We'll come back. I want to find out what the respondent, can they testify in this competency hearing and what they can say as well, too. We'll come back in just a moment here on a Coastal Daybreak. And Let's Talk Legal with Harbell and Collins. As always, you can call in with your questions, too, at 800-818-2255, 247-7282-353-4674. You can go online to harbellandcollins.com. Hey, welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harbell and Collins. Cecil Harbell and Wes Collins in the studio with us here today talking about guardianship and the first step about incompetency and declaring that and coming to that determination. Now, I wanted to ask you, though, is it the respondent? Are they, what role do they have? Do they testify in this procedure?
The alleged incompetent.
Yeah, right.
Excuse me. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. If they, of course, are able to testify,
right,
and appear, sometimes, of course, you know, that's not the case. They, mm-hmm. Have been in a tragic accident and are in a coma or mm-hmm. are in advanced, conditions medically where they're unable to attend the hearing, unable to speak, mm-hmm. things of that nature. But in these more typical cases that come to mind of just the elder person, mm-hmm. Who is forgetful or who's not taking their medication, or even this scenario that we've talked about a lot about, you know, being uncooperative, mm-hmm. You know, they appear. Mm-hmm. And they are able to testify, and they do have their opinion, and it is important that it be heard.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that we want to also speak of today is that there is the guardian of the person,
mm-hmm.
there's the guardian of the property, or there is the guardian there's a guardian which is known as the general guardian, which is really the guardian of both.
Right.
The general guardian is the easiest one to talk about. It means mm-hmm. the guardian of both the person and the property.
Mm-hmm.
The guardian of the property is pretty easy to get our head around. It's the person in charge of the property mm-hmm. of the incompetent person. Their bank accounts, their stocks, their bonds, their IRAs, their land, their mm-hmm. cars, their boats, any of their property of any nature in the world comes within the auspices of the guardian of the property.
So this guardian then
files a bond,
right.
Okay, must file a bond with mm-hmm. the clerk, and then takes an oath of office as the guardian of the property,
mm-hmm.
and then proceeds to take care of the property, but must file accountings with the clerk
mm-hmm.
year after year after year after year until such time as ever the guardianship is either terminated for whatever reason, or in other words, like a restoration of rights,
right.
or either, of course, the death of the incompetent person.
Mm-hmm.
So there is accountability to the court by the guardian, and it is durable in nature. It will continue throughout the incompetency.
So, but once incompetency is established, can multiple people apply to be a guardian, petition for that guardianship?
Yeah, well, once the incompetency is established, yeah, I understand your question. I didn't totally understand that at first, but yeah, what's going to happen is the petitioner is going to indicate in the petition that's filed who they recommend to be the guardian. It could be themselves, mm-hmm. usually it is,
mm-hmm.
or it could be someone else, anyone else who believes that someone else, in addition to that person who is elected themselves, basically, or someone else, can come forward and say, no, I think I'd be better
right.
to serve in that particular role. And then they would need to put on evidence with regard to that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Cecil is, you know, correct, of course, with regard to the different types of guardianship, you know, and the different types of guardian. You know, sometimes we have a power of attorney that's working fine with regard to financial issues. So we keep that in place with regard to the financial issues, but we just have a guardian appointed, for the person so that the guardian can make decisions with regard to where the person lives, you know, establish jurisdiction here in North Carolina with regard to, you know, any issues mm-hmm. pertaining to the ward. Make a decision as to what doctor the person goes to, those type things. And that keeps the family from having to go through, you know, posting a bond. I mean, it's not that difficult to do, but there's expense there, you know, with posting a bond. The clerk does have the authority in the event that, you know, the family can live with the possibility of the clerk entering an order freezing the assets in lieu of a bond. Mm-hmm. So if the family doesn't want to go out and post a bond, or the guardian doesn't want to post a bond to protect the assets, then the clerk can enter, you know, an order that basically says, okay, we understand that the monthly expenses are $3,000 a month, for example. Well, you can't take money out of the guardianship funds without an order of the court. So what you need to do is make an application to the court, basically on a monthly basis, for that $3,000 a month disbursement.
An allowance, basically.
Yep. Some clerks will do that. So basically, one of the reasons that the court is so very careful, and sometimes these guardianship cases become complicated, is because you understand that you're putting complete control in someone's hands. And if you don't, you know, get control of those issues, and you don't address that with an order of the court, then potentially, you know, that guardian could abuse their position and abuse their role. There are built-in safeguards in the statutes with regard to the money, obviously, because that's the highest risk area.
Exactly.
Someone might end up, you know, abusing their role. Those safeguards being, you know, the posting of the bond to protect for, you know, breach of that fiduciary duty, or in the alternative, you know, an order staying or freezing those guardianship assets subject to further applications to the court. So, you know, in my experience, you know, dealing with these assets, clerks are really careful about that. They're very careful. They want to know about all the assets. They want to know about, you know, where they are, who has control of them. Is there a trust out there maybe that's outside of the guardianship estate? You know, are the assets joint? Are they, you know, in just individual assets? What are the monthly expenses? They really want a lot of detail with regard to that. It's not just a rubber stamp of, okay, yep, we think you're incompetent. Okay, yep, you're the best person. See you later.
Right.
A lot of times they really get into those details.
Because they're protecting the best interests of the
their job is very important with regard to that.
Yeah. All right. More to come in just a moment here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. As always, you can find out great information online at harvellandcollins.com. Hey, welcome back. Talking about guardianship with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law. And Cecil, we want to talk also about the guardian of the person.
Yes. Sometimes there is the limitation of the guardian of the person, which, of course, that would be a guardianship where it's necessary for the guardian to decide where the where our loved one would reside, which rehabilitation center they would be at, which hospital, which convalescent home, which nursing home, how their person would be cared for. This is very different and distinctive from the guardian of the property. So there are two different types of guardianship. One is the guardian of the person. The other is the guardian of the property. Sometimes they are bifurcated. Other times they are not. If they are not bifurcated, then you might have what we many times refer to as a general guardian. A general guardian then would be guardian over both the person and the property.
Okay. So on those cases there too, where you have that general, do you ever revoke the power of attorney or?
That's an interesting dynamic we deal with in these cases, because you would think by, you know, a guardianship being put in place that would automatically revoke any existing power of attorney for the respondent who is now a ward of the state. But that's not true. The clerk can make that determination. The clerk can consider whether there is a power of attorney or not and make a determination as to whether it's necessary to keep it in place or not. Now, the legal ramifications of there being a power of attorney as opposed to, you know, just a guardianship, because there can certainly be a guardianship and a power of attorney at the same time.
Right.
We can continue to use the power of attorney. But the legal ramifications are pretty far-reaching, because if you have a guardianship in place, The statutes are very specific about what you can do as the guardian dealing with that ward's assets, and certain things you cannot do at all mm-hmm. without the superior court, resident superior court judge approving that. You have to have a hearing. You have to give notice. It has to be considered. Let's say that we need to sell the house, for example, mm-hmm. to pay for medical expenses. If we do, you know, if it's not a Medicaid issue or whatever, then, you know, you can't just summarily do that through a guardianship. You have to get approval from the court to do it. However, if we had a power of attorney in place and a guardianship, mm-hmm. well, we would be able to sell the property through the power of attorney without court approval. So it just depends on the circumstances. If we want a very high level of control and we want all transactions to be public record and for there to be complete transparency across the board, then, yeah, we probably want that power of attorney to go away.
Right.
If we want things to be a little easier and less cumbersome and less expensive, and we're not that concerned about the transparency issue with, the, say, the sale of the house, then, hey, we'd rather have that power of attorney in place just to keep things a little easier for us. Mm-hmm. So you got to take each case on a case-by-case basis, look at the personalities, look at the history, look at the family members, and go from there and make a decision on that.
And we'll have more next week, of course, here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. But in the meantime, you want to call and make that appointment and call the folks at Harvell and Collins at 252-726-9050. That's 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City, and online at harvellandcollins.com, 252-726-9050.